this morning, U.S. versus Lathrop. Mr. Morris.
May it please the Court, my name is D.L. Morris, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Philip Lathrop. Foreman of the jury that convicted Mr. Lathrop of arson has a brother who works for the same insurance company that insured the business that Mr. Lathrop allegedly hired someone to torch. The failure of defense counsel to strike this biased juror was ineffective assistance. On day one of the trial, during voir dire, all the prospective jurors were asked specifically whether they had any relationship themselves or other family members with a relationship to either the business that Mr. Lathrop insured or the insurance company at issue in the arson trial. Juror R did not answer that question. This afternoon session of the second day of trial, Juror R discloses to the court that his brother, in fact, works for Capital Indemnity, the insurance company at issue. In response to this question, defense counsel, when approached by the court, does nothing. In fact, he says and requests that the court bring up the issue later. The second opportunity that defense counsel had to address this issue came at the end of the fourth day of the trial, where defense counsel, upon being asked by the court whether he would like to have this juror stricken, responds that he had forgotten all about the issue. He had put it behind him. Mr. Van Wagner, defense counsel's explanation for his lack of response to the bias of Juror R is that, first and foremost, this was Mr. Lathrop, his client's favorite juror. Surprisingly, Mr. Van Wagner, when we look through the testimony, or the second point, if I might say, is that defense counsel explained that he didn't know anything else about alternate jurors. So the two reasons that defense counsel suggests as to why he did not take issue with Juror R's disclosure is that this was the defendant's favorite juror, and he didn't know anything about the alternates. But when we really look into whether this was a valid strategic decision on the part of defense counsel, his explanations fail. For the first point is that he didn't have informed consent from the client. Out of all the explanation that Mr. Van Wagner explains as to why this was Mr. Lathrop's favorite client and that he discussed the issue with Mr. Lathrop, which Mr. Lathrop does contest in his evidentiary testimony, but even taking Mr. Van Wagner's testimony as true, he didn't receive informed consent because he never once explained during all his evidentiary testimony, he never once testified that he explained the issue, the potential danger that was evident by having Juror R on the bench. Yes, there might have been other evidence or other testimony that Juror R had testified to during voir dire that maybe was appealable to Mr. Lathrop. He liked ESPN radio. He seemed like a bar guy. But at the point where this disclosure comes, the second day of trial, afternoon session, it was incumbent upon Mr. Van Wagner to actually inform his client if he is going to allege his trial strategy was based upon Mr. Lathrop's preferences. It was his duty to inform Mr. Lathrop of the potential dangers of keeping this juror on the panel without following up, without asking any other follow-up questions, without requesting the court to follow up as to whether this juror could still render an impartial verdict.
Is there some law that supports that proposition, that defense counsel is required to consult with the defendant and get informed consent on every decision to strike a juror?
No, but where the law comes into play is that it was objectively unreasonable for Mr. Defense Counsel to purport that his decisions were based on valid strategic trial strategy because of his conversations with Mr. Lathrop. So he wasn't required to discuss with Mr. Lathrop this issue. And, in fact, the government, during evidentiary hearing, even brings to point the fact that this wasn't Mr. Lathrop's call. This was defense counsel's call. And defense counsel's call, in our opinion, of course, was a bad call. Going on, as I explained, Mr. Lathrop testified that if he had the options, if he had understood the potential dangers, if he'd had the opportunity to address whether he wanted to, or if Mr. Van Wagner, defense counsel, had discussed the options with Mr. Lathrop, he would not have wanted this juror on the panel. It was a clear danger to having a juror whose brother is related to the insurance company at issue remain on the panel in light of the case that Mr. Lathrop was facing, a case that I might point out Judge Crabb noted to be a close call. This wasn't just an open and shut situation. This was a case where there was a variety of testimony on both sides that could go either way, which, again, underscores the importance of ensuring an impartial jury to decide this issue. I think, as case law has indicated, courts have found that depending on the relationship that the juror bears to a party in the case, depending on whether the juror was rehabilitated by counsel of the court, depending on whether the juror, subsequent to some disclosure that presents an issue, provides some sort of assurance of impartiality, find to be important issues in determining whether the purported trial strategy or the remaining to keep a juror on the panel was a violation of a defendant's Sixth Amendment right. In this case, I think that differs from all the others is that you have a disclosure of a blaring statement of bias that definitely should raise extreme caution.
I thought your argument was based on implied bias because of the relationship rather than actual bias here. There's nothing in the record that suggests that this is a case of actual juror bias. It's an implied bias case.
You're correct that juror R never said expressly, I could not be fair in this case. I think we could look at the surrounding facts and circumstances, as Your Honor suggests, and indicate that this was a clear presumptive bias in the nature of his relationship, in the nature of juror R's selective responses to voir dire questioning prior, and just the materiality of the relationship that he holds to a significant party at issue in the case.
Could he have been excused for cause?
He could have been excused for cause, and I believe that the court was willing during day four of the trial to grant Mr. Van Wagner, defense counsel, that option. Surprisingly, even to the government, defense counsel declined that opportunity. So I think that, if I might conclude on this issue, is that the fact that defense counsel's purported strategic strategy fails is that there wasn't any informed consent from his client, if he's going to say that he based his decision on Mr. Lathrop's suggestions. The juror R was at least presumptively biased due to the surrounding circumstances and the nature and timing of his disclosure. And that overall, considering the fact that this wasn't just an open and shut case, that as Judge Crabb stated, a case that raised a lot of issues, it was objectively unreasonable for defense counsel to allow this juror to remain on the panel, and it was prejudicial to Mr. Lathrop in the fact that it allowed a tainted juror to continue to permeate the effect of the entire trial.
You've got a couple of other issues about
I do.
The failure to call witnesses?
Yes, if I might turn to the second issue. Defense counsel provided ineffective assistance of counsel by failing to conduct a proper investigation of testimony that would have been reasonably likely to persuade a jury of Mr. Lathrop's innocence. I think that the key point in this issue is that when there's available testimony that's non-cumulative, that hasn't been provided anywhere else, that is going to help shape and color the defense of a client, it should be used. And I think the failure to use it and the failure to provide a valid strategic basis for not using that is prejudicial and is ineffective assistance. The government suggests that Mr. Van Wagner, defense counsel's trial strategy was three issues. One was to attack government witnesses, motives, interests, and biases. Second was to defend a financial motive, and third is to humanize Mr. Lathrop.
So one of those objectives went directly to the thrust of the government's case. The thrust of the government's case was that this fellow had every reason in the world to want to burn down that bar at that particular time.
Correct.
The defense really spoke directly to that point, didn't it?
Well, I feel like they sidestepped that point. If you would suggest that the strongest point the government attempted to portray was the financial motive, which I think was very clear from the outset, that they really sought to show that Mr. Lathrop was in dire straits and that's where he was desperate and went to burn down the bar for the insurance money. My time has expired. I could continue to respond. However, the key witness, if I might suggest, that could have kind of tied up the entire defense on behalf of Mr. Lathrop would have been Ms. Rolfing, Ms. Jennifer Rolfing, who not only could have testified to the personal and professional record-keeping of the bar, as well as the personal relationship that she has to Mr. Lathrop that would have succeeded in defending the second point as to humanizing the defendant.
But according to the record, they thought about calling her. There was a downside to calling her. And they decided the downside outweighed the upside of this thing. And that's just a discretionary call, isn't it?
Well, I think, depending on if you were to take Mr. Van Wagner's testimony as true, because Ms. Rolfing does testify at evidentiary hearing, and she reports that she was there, ready and willing to testify, and was told basically at the last minute that she wasn't going to testify. She wanted to testify. Mr. Van Wagner's point in not having her testify because of, you know, the appearance that she would be Mr. Lathrop's meal ticket or a puppet, it really falls short in consideration of the totality of the other circumstances that were.
You also said they didn't think she could handle the cross-examination.
I think it's kind of after the fact, but her evidentiary testimony demonstrated very clearly that she could handle an examination if she was even interviewed or prepared. The record demonstrates that she wasn't ever contacted by Mr. Van Wagner or his investigator at any time prior to the trial. So it wasn't until after the trial began that he even began to communicate with Ms. Rolfing. So, you know, to say at the last minute that, you know, she wouldn't have been ready, well, maybe that's part of the reason that we're here in the first place, his ineffective assistance in preparing her.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dan Graber. I represent the United States. I was the trial attorney at AUSA that handled the trial. I also was the AUSA that handled the evidentiary hearing. Let me just touch on the last point counsel made with regards to the financial motive. Mr. Van Wagner did have a strategy and a plan that he executed on financial motive, rebutting the financial motive that I was trying to put in at trial. He called bartenders and bouncers in the case to explain that, in their opinion, business at the bar was not going down. He put on Marty Gall, who was the guy that ran the gaming machines, to show that the gaming machines were still full of coin and that was their busy season in August of the year, to show that the bar was making business, and that was his way of trying to rebut the financial motive. He believed that was a much more effective way of doing it than putting on tax returns and an accountant, which he believed, first of all, he testified, the returns were bogus, they were created after the fact, they weren't true, and that people like Jennifer Rolling as well as Kevin Mell, the accountant, were going to have to take on water because they would be cross-examined by me on the issue of a cash skim. They were engaging in a cash skim. They were engaging in employment tax fraud. They were engaging in income tax fraud. And he didn't want to go down that road. And Judge Crabb agreed. And that's one matter I want to bring up, which kind of folds into this other issue with regards to the biased juror argument. And that is the standard of review. I make a big point in the brief to talk about standard of review, because the defense claims we're working on a de novo standard review. That's not right. We're here on a Rule 33 denial. This court has made quite clear that you don't do an ineffective assistance claim on direct appeal. You go down to the district court level, either on a Rule 33 motion for trial or 2255, and you flesh out the issue. You have an evidentiary hearing. You have the district judge listen to the witnesses, try to figure out who's telling the truth, look at the documents, develop a record, and then bring it up on appeal. That's what happened here. They chose to do a Rule 33 motion for new trial, their basis being ineffective assistance, and we had a two-day hearing. They called nine witnesses. I called three. and it was fully fleshed out, and Judge Crabb made findings afterwards. And the issue, she listened to Jennifer Rolfing and Philip Lathrop talk about things, and she listened to Chris Van Wagner, and she chose to believe Van Wagner, and in her findings she says, I believe Van Wagner. On the issue of why his trial strategy on financial motive, I believe that was the right way to go. It would have been horrible. She says that, you know, that putting the tax returns in would have been dynamite for the government. And Mr. Van Wagner exercised good common sense in staying away from that. They ignore all that in their brief, and in their and the reason that's important is because we're on abuse of discretion standard review for the Rule 33. So we're on a real deferential standard of review to begin with on the Rule 33 motion. And then we've got the Strickland standard, which is another really deferential review. The court's scrutiny of counsel's performance is highly deferential because it's presumed what they do is reasonable, and this court will not engage in Monday morning second-guessing of counsel's performance because there's a multitude of ways that an attorney can represent a client. So we've got two very deferential standards of review, and we go to the juror issue now. Chris Van Wagner made a strategy call not to strike him and not to ask questions about, to Mr. Richard. He made that call based on the fact that he and Phil Lathrop, when they put that jury together, they found that they liked Richard. Mr. Richard was a young kid, 26 years old. He liked ESPN. He liked sports. He liked watching TV. They wanted that guy. When it came up on the second day of trial, he turns to Lathrop and says, that's our favorite juror. Lathrop says, yeah, I want to keep him. Now, Lathrop says on their evidentiary hearing, I never said that. Van Wagner says, that's what happened. And Judge Crabb believed Van Wagner and not Lathrop. That was his decision based on that. And he also explained, look, the next alternate was Mr. Robus. We didn't like Robus. And the next alternate after that was Mr. I forget the name of the next alternate, but they didn't have any information about them. So they didn't want to strike Richard and go with alternates that they didn't like or didn't know. He explained that, and that's an important point because Judge Crabb believed that. She said, you know, this is a non-issue. What Mr. Van Wagner says makes sense to me, and that was the end of the issue. Now, another point counsel makes is there's bias. And Judge Sykes, you mentioned that there's no showing of actual bias. Correct, because Mr. Richard never said actual bias. And you said, well, maybe this is an implied bias case. That's apparently the argument they have to make because Judge Crabb never found any kind of bias. And if you look at the decisions that they cite in their brief as to implied bias, when you're dealing with the world of implied bias, this court says very rarely do you guys go down that road. And usually it's in extreme or exceptional circumstances when the juror is in the same, basically stands in the shoes of the defendant or something happens. The cases he cites.
Again, the relationship between the insurance company, was the insurance company he was?
Yeah, Mr. Richard's brother worked for Capital Insurance Company, which was the victim insurance company. So he tells the bailiff that, and the bailiff comes up to Judge Crabb and says that, and she brings this up. And they make the decision right away. They're not going to do it, but they don't tell me. He says, I don't want to tip off Graber because I'm afraid Graber's going to try to knock the guy off. I want to play it close to the vest. So when she brings it up a second time, right before she's about to dismiss the jury, for deliberation, she brings it up again, and he makes a statement, oh, I forgot. I asked him about that at the evidentiary hearing. He says, the reason I said that was because Phil and I had already figured out that we wanted this guy, and we had already moved on. And so he said, no, I want him. I don't want him struck. We want him on. So he went back to deliberate. That's all I have, unless the court has any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Morris, you took this case by appointment, did you not? And you have the thanks of the court for doing so and for ably representing your client. Thank you. Case